This is the podcast for Monday, October 17th, 2011, Ethics. So to begin with, just an announcement, I'll say this again for the benefit of the online students. The deadline to take the exam without an extension is Wednesday at 7 o'clock. You must arrive 1 hour before the lab closes. So that would mean the very latest you could get there was Wednesday at 6. That doesn't mean that everyone who hasn't taken the test yet should show up Wednesday at 6. But that's the latest that you have to take it. Okay. So we're going to begin with egoism today. Raise your hand if you've ever done anything for somebody else without some secret selfish motive. Okay, just about everybody. Maybe I see a couple of people that they're not sure, they're saying no. So, if you raise your hand, then you realize that psychological egoism is a bunch of bunk. It's a silly theory. It's a silly theory for reasons described in the text, which briefly stated are...
Well, first of all, what does psychological egoism say? What's the definition?
Well, you said the right act is that which furthers individual self-interest.
That's the definition of ethical egoism. What's psychological egoism?
All acts are motivated by self-interest.
Yeah,
whether they know it or not.
All acts are selfish, if you want to shorten it, or self-interested. I mean, there's so many problems with this. First of all, if you think about your own inner life, unless you're a psychopath or your mom dropped from your head when you're young or something, you've done things for other people. Like just today, for example. So just see what you think about this. So I'm coming in to the college, taking this photo class. I got to be there at 11:30. It's 11:15. I'm doing pretty good. I want to go up to my office, put down my junk, sort through my papers before heading off to class. So as I'm coming up, I see David Young, who's a psychology instructor, and David's on crutches. He did something to his foot, and he's just coming out of the elevator, right? And so I see him coming towards me, and what do you think I did? I'm coming through the door.
Dodged
him. I say, see you later, David, and like dash for the elevator because, the elevator door opens, the elevator door closed. No, I took the door and I said, he's hobbling over towards the door, expecting me to open it. I hold the door open for him, right? And he comes through, and I watch the elevator door close. I'm thinking, so I can either stand there for another, 10 minutes for waiting for the elevator to stop at every floor and go up and down, or take the stairs. I'm like, I guess I'll take the stairs, right? So I gave a little bit of sacrifice, right? I would have preferred, if I was just thinking in terms of self-interest, I would have preferred to go up on the elevator. But because of my friend David that I have a relationship with, I wanted to help him. And even if it was a stranger on crutches, I think I would have done the same. Now, my thinking, what's the psychological ego is going to say about my actions?
Well,
yeah.
I agree it's stupid. Unless you do depends upon what you mean by being is.
In other words, selfish, maybe.
If you do that, then you hold in the elevator because it's something you wanted to do. And doing what you want to do is in your self-interest. Everything that you choose to do, except if somebody's dragging you to the gallows and you don't want to go there, you are doing because you choose to do it. If you look at it that way, by definition, it's true. It's not the place anybody lives. But by definition, it's true.
But is the definition that all choices are selfish? It seems to be circular then.
No, like, it's not circular.
If you're saying if you're doing what you want to do is in your self-interest, I suppose.
Yeah. If your self-interest is self-actualization, I am most important. I will do what I want to do. That is the most important thing. If it makes me feel good on any level at all, I choose to do it, even though it seems like an inconvenience. It makes me feel good. It's what I want to do.
So So when I'm holding the door open for David, I said, okay, as soon as he goes through there, I'm going to feel those good feelings kind of coming up from my belly and filling my whole body. I'm going to feel like such a good person.
No, I'm saying that largely it's done out of your awareness. But it's what people do. If you look at it that way, it absolutely is.
Well, it's not as if that's my motive, though. My motive is to help my friend. Now, I might feel good as a result, but that's not why I intend to do the thing that I do.
But that's why you do it, because you want to do it. It makes you feel good.
But I'm not doing it to feel good. I'm doing it to help my friend. Yeah.
So back to your original question, from a psychological egoism standpoint, you helped David because later it continues to improve your relationship with David so that you get things out of him later.
So I think, oh, all right, now I'm gonna hold the door open for David, and then next week when I need some help with some site, like I kind of talked about psychology, he's going to help me out because, tip or tat, right?
Yeah.
Maybe I go back to my office, I put a little tally mark, David owes me another one, right? I'm like, I got to make sure to collect. Come on, nobody acts like that, nobody thinks like that, no one behaves like that. Well, some people do, like, you get certain people do, like, Hollywood, and sometimes in business, you get people that deal in that way, but they're not dealing in in a moral and ethical way, and they don't deal like that all the time. Typically, there's people that they help out of the goodness of their heart or not expecting any return, but there might be a few people that don't. But why should morality be built on a few the behavior of a few psychopaths? There's somebody way in the back that had a question.
Yeah, it was what you did was nice, and he was your friend. But would your real inner test come if it was a perfect stranger, if you would have done the same thing?
Well, I think I would have done the same for a stranger. I've done that before.
I think.
What?
You think you would have.
Well, no, I have. I've helped perfect strangers before. Now, there's another stranger. So here's another couple of cases. So I'm driving home in the Grove, and I see this guy walking by the side of the road. And he's got a backpack on, kind of looks like a student, and he's walking along. And he's like puts his thumb out when the cars come by. And I kind of go by him, and I start as I'm thinking about it. And I'm thinking, I'm not in any hurry. And that guy, who knows how far, he probably doesn't have far to walk. Because, in the Grove, like, things aren't that, close. I'm like, but it's probably going to take him a long time. So I, like, turned around, and I gave the guy a ride. And, he's just like some guy that his car's busted up and he had a bicycle, but then somebody stole it. And so he lives out in the outskirts of town. I think he would have been walking for he was like kind of way out. It took me about maybe like 5 or 10 minutes to drive outside of town, drop him off, and drive back. But I probably would have taken him like 45 minutes to make that walk. Now that I think, I'm going to feel really good if I help this guy, I'm thinking, it's going to be a small sacrifice on my part, and it's going to significantly benefit this person that I don't even know, and I just stop. Now, on the other hand, I was coming into campus today, and there's a guy walking by the side of the road with a gas can, and he's coming up on the off-ramp. And it was going to be hard to pull over going at the coming on the freeway, going at the speed I was. By the time I saw him, I would have had to pull over and slam on the brakes. And plus, I had that 15 minutes to get to class, right? So I didn't have time to drive this guy to the gas station. It wouldn't be late. So there, it's like a big sacrifice, which could benefit him a little bit. And then I just kept on driving. I figured, he'll have to suck it up. So it seems like if you think about sacrifice, it's not like I never help anybody, but I'm not willing to sacrifice, my whole day and my significant things and break obligations to other people too. So most people do little things like this for other people all the time. Common courtesy, holding the door, a perfect stranger you'll never see before. And you don't do it because you think, I'm going to feel really good after I do this. You do that because it's a good thing to do. It's like people talk about they want to make the world a better place for, say, future generations. Well, why? What has posterity ever done for me? Right? So people think of this way. If you think that it's good to want to make the world a better place, then you're not a psychological egoist. Yeah.
I was just curious people do nice things for each other out of submitting sympathy, putting yourself in their position. Can you do that? Is that also selfish?
Well, that's a good question. Is doing something out of sympathy selfish? There's this weird thing, like, do you have to consciously think, what if that was me? Or maybe that's like maybe the reason you feel that way is because that's built into your brain. And your brain works that way because way back when, you're living in a cave and helping somebody in your group was helping someone who was carrying your genes. And so that's the way why you feel that way. But it's not your conscious motive. Yeah.
So but it's not a conscious consideration. Is that making it unselfish? Can it only be a selfish action if you take the time to rationalize that you're doing it out of sympathy?
Yeah, I think like to have a motive is to do something for a reason. You could do it because you feel a certain way, I suppose. But it comes down to, if you have an intention, that means you have some conscious motive. Because you really can't, you can act being caused to do something from an unconscious motive. But it's different from an intentional act. So an intentional act is when you do something for a reason. Like, I want to help David, so I hold the door open for him. What would be acting from an unconscious motive? My father had polio, and I always held the door open for him when he came home from work, and it gave me warm, fuzzy feelings. And so maybe that unconscious motive makes me hold the door open for disabled people or have a soft spot for them. And I suppose if I'm just doing it like that, then maybe it's not really a selfish or unselfish motive. It's kind of like a reaction or something. Yeah.
If you look at David coming and you say, punch the button anyway.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't have felt good. So I'm guessing if you had some sort of moral tinge in you, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that. My point was simply that you chose to do it because you thought it was right, was acting consistently what you believe, who you are, that is the reason why you do it. Whether you're aware of it or not, every choice you make is amazing. Everything you do is intentional. You do it for a reason. And just parsing it, I'm just intentional. Parsing it, you get down underneath everything. You do it because you think it's right to do it. And it's consistent with who you are. You're trying to be consistent with your
own. Right.
Whether you're aware of it or not.
But I do it because it's right, not because I want to.
Do you do things that are right because it makes you feel good or bad?
No.
Why do you do things that are right?
Because they're right.
That's no answer.
No, it's a perfectly good answer. There's two reasons you can do what things. One, because you want to do them, and the other one, because they're right or good. And those are different kinds of reasons. I help David because it's right to do it. Now, I might also want to do it. So sometimes those two things intersect. Like, if I enjoy being nice to people and it's good to be nice to people, then that's good. I mean, often those things do intersect. But often they don't. Like, people do things they don't want to do. Why? Because they should do them. I mean, I'm sure everyone in this room can think of something that you really, really didn't want to do, but you did it because you felt that you ought to do it, or that you should do it, or you thought it was your moral obligation. And that's all you need to get a wedge into, say, psychological egoism isn't going to fly. That sometimes you do things that aren't in your interest, that you don't really want to do, but you do them anyway because you should. Yeah.
How do you decide what's right and wrong then? By your own little moral standards, and then wouldn't that also tie into acting on your own self-interest? If you think it's right, then you should do it.
That's the topic of this course, about what makes things right or wrong. So anyway, I'm giving you a counter-argument to psychological egoism. You can still hold on to this theory if you want, but it's unfalsifiable. There's no way you might think, oh, you can't prove it wrong, therefore it's a really good theory. But any theory you can't even think of a counterexample for, even in like the realm of possibility, isn't really a theory. it's a dogma, right? It's like if I say the Jews run the world and control the media, and you say, well, what about Rupert Murdoch? He's not a Jew. And I say, yeah, well, they need a couple of Gentile puppets so people won't get wise to their scheme. Right? So it's like, it's not really a theory anymore, because if you raise an objection, like, well, not all Jews control the world. Look at Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, he's not Jewish. And I could say, well, that's like part of the plot or something like that. And so you make a little adjustment, and it shows it's not really a theory. It's like, oh, what about the guy that jumped on a hand grenade? Oh, well, he just wanted to feel like a hero. What about Mother Teresa going around helping people? Well, sure, bag is helping people. And to say that, like, think about two people like Mother Teresa and Bernard Madoff, like the guy that ran this investment scheme where there was no real investment. Yeah, Ponzi scheme, right, like Social Security, where he's like paying off the old people with the new money, right? Just like we're doing with our retirement system in the United States. Are you seriously saying that Mother Teresa is no more or no less selfish than Bernie Madoff, who like built people out of millions of dollars to live a lavish lifestyle versus Mother Teresa, who's living in poverty and spends her whole life helping people? That seems like a kind of tough bullet to bite. And I see another objection over there.
No, it's not good. I actually want some help understanding a view which cannot be disproven, even in principle, can't be made in any real or significant claim. An example, and I'm really asking for persistence.
A little louder, please. I have a problem hearing.
This room has gravity. If I let go of this, it's going to drop. All right? That is not disprovable, even in principle. How does that not make any real claim? I don't understand the difference that we're talking about.
You're saying gravity is not disproved?
I'm saying that the proposition I did here, trying to follow that model, I did something that can't be disproved.
Right.
Does that make it not real?
If you were to hold that bottle in midair and let go of it, and it just floated there, when we were looking up and we made sure there's no wires up and down there, we say, wow, gravity has an exception, right? You can imagine that possibility. So that would be a falsifiable instance. Whereas with psychological egoism, you can't come up with like, okay, suppose a person did this, suppose a person did that, and the psychological egoist would say, nope, here's selfish reason, selfish reason, selfish reason. There's always going to be some selfish reason. So you say, okay, well, Mr. Psychological Egoist, give me an example of an action that wouldn't be selfish, and I'll see if I can come up with an example. Give me the sort of action that you think wouldn't fall under your definition of selfish. And then you say, well, there aren't any. Well, if you can't think of a possible exception of any possible scenario where a theory could be disproven, then it's not really a theory. It's not an empirical theory. It's a kind of a dogma, or it's an empty theory. It's not really saying anything.
Yes. Does that mean that by definition, all dogma is false?
Honestly, it's just not a real theory. It's not making a significant claim. Because if you're claiming all acts are selfish, well then, what does this word mean? Is this a word without meaning? Is it just syllables? In order for this word to have meaning, this word has to have meaning. In order for an act to be selfish, you have to say what unselfish could be. It's like if I say, this coffee is lukewarm, and you like put your finger in, it's like that's near boiling. I said, well, you know, lukewarm is, you know, it just means that it's like not 6,000 degrees or something. Or you could say, well, what do you mean by lukewarm? How would you define that? Or just
a bad example.
Let's take like hot and cold, right? I mean, hot only has meaning in reference to cold. Selfish, unselfish, hot and cold, or you can take other examples, of opposites. So unless you can give an example of an unselfish act, the claim that all acts are selfish is a tautology, right? It's It's a claim without meaning.
Yeah. So what you're saying is lava that's gone cold could still be 2,000 degrees in solid rock form.
Yeah, I guess. I know that's probably the hot and cold is probably a better example. So you understand hot in contrast to cold, but you can't think about if you can't qualify what an unselfish act would be and say, okay, well, if a person would do this, then that would be unselfish. But nobody ever does that, and nobody you can't point to any examples of that. Or for some reason, you don't think that anyone would do that kind of action. As opposed, so if you can't come up with an example of what an unselfish act would be like the bottle floating in midair, then it's not really a real theory, and it's certainly not an empirical theory. Like the psychological egoist will say, well, look out there in the world, look at your experience. Every time you do something, there's some selfish motive there. And then you say, well, what would? It seems like I help people all the time, and I do things which are against my interest, and they say, oh yeah, well, there's some secret subconscious motive that you're not aware of. And it's kind of like, you know, if I say, to take another example, suppose I say, you may think that 2 and 2 is 4, but really 2 and 2 is 5, but God always takes away 1, making it 4. Right? Is that a real theory? I mean, how would you disprove that? And then you say, well, what effect does it have on mathematical theory? And I say, oh, no, mathematical theory is going to be exactly the same, but the reality behind it is God always takes away 1. There would be no way to prove that. Or if I say I have an invisible friend who makes sure that when I write with a blue pen, it never turns any other color. And without my invisible friend, it might turn pink or blue or yellow or something like that. Okay, and you can say, well, what if... So write something without your invisible friend. I say I'd like to, but he won't go away. He just keeps on making sure that when I write with a blue pen, it turns out blue on the board. But if he weren't there, it would turn pink. But since he's always there and refuses to leave, then it's always going to be blue. I mean, it's just it doesn't make any difference It doesn't make any difference in empirical reality. It's not a real theory. And psychological egoism is like that because it says every act is selfish, and when you report from your own experience an act that you did to help somebody else, they'll say, okay, well, here's your secret motive. It's this thing right here. And they always point to something. Or they say, well, you wanted to help that person, didn't you? Well, yeah, I wanted to help that person. Well, you were just trying to fulfill a desire, and that means it was selfish. It's like, well, yeah, my desire was to help this person. It wasn't a selfish desire, it was an altruistic desire. Yeah.
Why is egoism under absolute realism in that skepticism? I don't really see what the right and wrong
of that. Oh, so this is a psychological theory. This is a theory of human nature. So this isn't really an ethical theory at all. So one of the reasons we're talking about psychological egoism is to distinguish it from ethical egoism. Ethical egoism is the view that that the right, as you said, the right act is the self-interested act. So what's right? What's right is whatever is in your interest. What's wrong is whatever is against your interest. So this assumes that it's possible to act against your own interests. Assumes. So this assumes psychological egoism is false. Well, most of the time, I suppose. I mean, there's some. If you're a psychological egoist, what's the only theory that's open to you as far as ethics goes? Of the realist theory. So kick skepticism to the side for a minute. So if you're going to be an ethical realist and you're a psychological egoist, what theory are you left with? Is it relative to your culture, your conscience, whether you act altruistically or not?
Okay, absolutely.
Right, you're going to end up with this. So I'll put this usually. I mean, if you say that the right thing to do is to act in your interest, it assumes that you can also act against your interest. An ethical theory of any kind typically assumes you have a choice and tries to guide you in that choice. But if you're a psychological egoist, you don't really have any choice, right? If you can only act selfishly, then, and you're not a moral skeptic, you end up as an ethical egoist. But I suppose most psychological egoists are probably moral skeptics. But if you had to hold on to a theory of right and wrong and you're a psychological egoist, ethical egoism is the only one that's going to work, right? Because all the other theories say that you have moral obligations which are different from your self-interest. Okay, I talked more about psychological egoism than I wanted to, but maybe there was some need for clarification. So on the exam, you'll just have to know these two definitions. Psychological egoism is a theory of human nature, and it says that all acts are selfish. It's not a moral theory at all. It's a theory of human nature, and it's a theory of psychology, right? It says every time you do something, it was for a selfish motive. And that's unfalsifiable and not really representative of people's experiences. And so for that reason, most philosophers reject psychological egoism. So now let's get to some real philosophy. If I had to think of like a theory that like a bankrupt, implausible theory, the only one I could think of, I suppose, relativism, might run a close second. But it sounds good when you first pitch it, but then you start thinking it through and you're thinking, no, that's not really going to work. Anyway, it's my unbiased, objective opinion. And never humble opinion. Okay, so let's talk about Hobbes and ethical egoism. So Hobbes is social contract theory, so maybe we should do Rand first. I think I, in the text, do I have, I'm trying to remember if I put Hobbes first or Rand first. I put Rand first, so let's talk about her. So let's see. How many people here saw Atlas Shrugged Part 1 in the theaters or on DVD or something? Anybody? Yeah, so it's going to be in three parts. Part 1 is already, it's available on DVD right now. And it's not bad. It's kind of a medium budget production. They did pretty good with what they had. It's got some good moments in it, I think. The book is really, the book's kind of long, but it's very meaty, very philosophical. I've given you sort of the highlights in the speech by John Galt of the philosophy, but there's a lot of other stuff that goes on. Some steamy sex scenes. Ms. Rand kind of had some kinks. And so the sex scenes are they're pretty steamy and a little kind of, I don't know what the word is for, on the wild side or whatever, but the Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead both are about individualism, and Ayn Rand saw individualism as the center of her philosophy, and it starts out with egoism, this idea that your mission in life is not to serve others, you are your own person, you with your own rational judgment decide how you should live your life. There's no social contract. There's no idea that you're required to be the slave of everyone else and go around sacrificing your interests for other people. You're there to be happy and to live your life according to your own principles. And so she saw that as sort of all coming out of a rational worldview. So you start out with reason, an approach to life. Reason tells you there's an objective reality and you need to do certain things to survive in the world and to flourish. And on the basis of that, she believed in free market capitalism. Laissez-faire, as they say. Separation of economy and state. Let's
interestingly enough, this was a kind of a radical view, and is getting more and more radical, I suppose, as time goes on. But her novel, The Fountainhead, is interesting in that it's really, it's more concerned with the arts. The main character there is an architect, and he wants to be true to his artistic vision. And a lot of it is sort of about art and literature. It tends to have this sort of nihilistic strain in it, and it's focused on you're not an individual, you're part of this collective, and you should obey authority, and you should instead of disobey. Right? This is Henry David Thoreau, often known for his work in naturalism, Walden's Pond. Right, the book Walden, right, and known for his essay on civil disobedience, but little known as a sort of he's kind of like Rand, a limited or anti-government person. So a lot of the lefties like to claim him, like the Wall Street protesters were like, yeah, civil disobedience, get Wall Street. Whereas Thoreau would say, well, you know, whose money is being invested in Wall Street? Is it your money? No, you're like some starving college student or some homeless person or some Union Joe. And maybe the Union Joe is a Union Joe. You got some money and a pension. But the idea is that that's not your money. What are you doing waving a sign? Why don't you go work and produce something, is what Thoreau would say. Now, if you're talking about like government corruption, maybe you're like in the wrong street. Maybe you should be at Pennsylvania Avenue. Maybe you're protesting on the wrong street. Because it's the Thoreau would say it's the government people who are causing all the problems, and responsible for the corruption on Wall Street such as it is. You know, Tim Geithner is from Goldman Sachs and he's a Treasury Secretary. Who got the most money in the last election cycle? No, it wasn't McCain. All the Wall Street people and the bankers, they gave the lion's share of their money to Obama. So. So if you think through on the sort of this sort of radical individualism viewpoint, this idea that you're the master of your fate, you're the captain of your soul, you control your life, and you can help people. It's not like you can't help people, but it's that you help the people you want to help. And when you help people, you're doing something heroic. It's not an obligation for you to spend all your time helping people. It's good of you that you help people, and you can be a benevolent person and a kind person. But it's Rand's view, which goes all the way back to Adam Smith and even David Hume, that when you focus on your own interests and when you produce something, it's going to be something of value to society, and that you get bad social effects when you get people that want to control others and tell you that you don't have a right to pursue your own goals and aspirations, but you need to focus on everyone else in society and benefiting everyone else, and that it's selfish and bad and wrong for you to focus on your own personal good or the good of your family. So here I'm going to show a little interview, a famous interview that Ayn Rand did with Mike Wallace back in 1959. And somebody in the back dim the lights. See how television, how far television has come.
This is Mike Wallace with another television portrait from our gallery of colorful people. Throughout the United States, small pockets of intellectuals have become involved in a new and unusual philosophy which would seem to strike at the very roots of our society. The fountainhead of this philosophy is a novelist, Ayn Rand, whose two major works, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, have been bestsellers. We'll try to find out more about her revolutionary cream, and about Miss Rand herself in just a moment. And now to our story. Down through history, various political and philosophical movements have sprung up, and most of them have died. Some, however, like democracy or communism, take hold and affect the entire world. Here in the United States, perhaps the most challenging and unusual new philosophy has been forged by a novelist, Ayn Rand. Miss Rand's point of view is still comparatively unknown in America, but if it ever did take hold, it would revolutionize our lives. And to begin with, I wonder if I can ask you to capsulize. I know this is difficult. Can I ask you to capsulize your philosophy? What is Randism?
First of all, I do not call it Randism, and I don't like that name. I call it objectivism.
Okay.
Meaning a philosophy based on objective reality. Now let me explain it as briefly as I can. First, my philosophy is based on the concept that reality exists as an objective absolute. That man's mind, reason, is his means of perceiving it. And that man needs a rational morality. I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on faith, not on faith, not on arbitrary whim, not on emotion, not on arbitrary edict, mystical or social, but on reason, a morality which can be proved by means of logic, which can be demonstrated to be true and necessary.
All right.
Now, may I define what my morality is?
All right.
Because this is merely an introduction. My morality is based on man's life as a standard of value. And since man's mind is his basic means of survival, I hold that if man wants to live on Earth and to live as a human being, he has to hold reason as an absolute, by which I mean that he has to hold reason as his only guide to action, and that he must live by the independent judgment of his own mind, that his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness, and that he must not force other people nor accept their right to force him, that each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
May I interrupt now?
You may.
Because you put this philosophy to work in your novel Atlas Shrugged.
Right.
You demonstrate it in human terms in your novel Atlas Shrugged. And let me start by quoting from a review of this novel Atlas Shrugged that appeared in Newsweek. It said that you are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Other reviews have said that you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes, I agree with the fact, but not the estimate of this criticism. Namely, if I am challenging the base of all these institutions, I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others, that man must sacrifice himself to others, which is the present-day morality.
What do you mean by sacrifice himself for others? Now we're getting to the point.
One moment. Since I'm challenging the base, I necessarily would challenge the institutions you name, which are a result of that morality. And now what is self-sacrifice?
Yes, what is self-sacrifice? You say that you do not like the altruism by which we live. You like a certain kind of Ayn Randist selfishness.
I would say that I don't like is too weak a word. I consider evil. And self-sacrifice is the precept that man needs to serve others in order to justify his existence, that his moral duty is to serve others. That is what most people believe today.
Well, yes, we're taught to feel concerned for our fellow man, to feel responsible for his welfare, to feel that we are, as religious people might put it, children under God and responsible one for the other. Now, why do you rebel? What's wrong with this philosophy?
But that is what, in fact, makes man a sacrificial animal. That man must work for others, concern himself with others, or be responsible for them. That is the role other sacrificial object. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself, but that he cannot demand that others give up their lives to make him happy. Nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others. I hold that man should have self-esteem.
And cannot man have self-esteem if he loves his fellow man? What's wrong with loving your fellow man? Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself. It is more than immoral, it's impossible. Because when you are asked to love everybody indiscriminately, that is to love people without any standard, to love them regardless of the fact of whether they have any value or virtue, you are asked to love nobody.
But in a sense, in your book, you talk about love as if it were a business deal of some kind. Isn't the essence of love that it is above self-interest?
Let me make it concrete for you. What would it mean to have a love above self-interest? It would mean, for instance, that a husband would tell his wife, if he were moral, according to the conventional morality, that I am marrying you just for your own sake. I have no personal interest in it, but I am so unselfish that I am marrying you only for your own good.
Well, should husbands and wives...
Would any woman like that?
Should husbands and wives, I tally up at the end of the day and say, well, now, wait a minute, I love her if she's done enough for me today, or she loves me if I have properly performed my functions.
No, you misunderstood me. That is not how love should be treated. I agree with you that it should be treated like a business deal, but every business has to have its own terms and its own kind of currency. And in love, the currency is virtue. You love people not for what you do for them or what they do for you. You love them for the values, the virtues which they have achieved in their own character. You don't love causelessly. You don't love everybody indiscriminately. You love only those who deserve it.
And then if a man is weak or a woman is weak, then she is beyond, he is beyond love?
He certainly does not deserve it. He certainly is beyond. He can always correct. Man has free will. If a man wants love, he should correct his weaknesses or his flaws, and he may deserve it. But he cannot expect the unearned, neither in love nor in money.
But you
neither in matter nor spirit.
You have lived in our world and you recognize the fallibility of human beings. There are very few of us then in this world, by your standards, who are worthy of love.
Unfortunately, yes, very few. But it is open to everybody to make themselves worthy of it, and that is all that my morality offers them.
If they will
a way to make themselves worthy of love, also that's not the primary motive.
Let's move ahead. Ha!
It takes a while to get used to the accent here. Oh, this stupid new YouTube thing.
How does your philosophy translate itself into the world of politics? Now, one of the principal achievements of this country in the past 20 years, particularly, I think most people agree, is that gradual growth of social protective legislation based on the principle that we are our brother's keepers. How do you feel about the political trends of the United States, the Western world?
The way everybody feels, except more consciously. I feel that it is terrible, that you see destruction all around you, and that you are moving toward disaster until and unless all those welfare state conceptions have been reversed and rejected. It is precisely these trends which are bringing the world to disaster, because we are now moving towards complete collectivism or socialism, a system under which everybody is enslaved to everybody, and we are moving that way only because of our altruist morality.
Ah, yes, but you say everybody is enslaved to everybody, yet this came about democratically. I, a free people in a free country, voted for this kind of government, wanted this kind of legislation. Do you object to the democratic process?
I object to the idea that people have the right to vote on everything. The traditional American system was a system based on the idea that majority will prevail only in public or political affairs, and that it was limited by inalienable individual rights. Therefore, I do not believe that the majority can vote a man's life or property or freedom away from him. Therefore, I do not believe that if a majority votes on any issue, that this makes the issue right. It doesn't.
All right. Then how do we arrive at action? How should we arrive at action?
By voluntary consent, voluntary cooperation of free men, unforced.
And how do our leaders arrive? How do we arrive at our leadership? Who elects? Who appoints?
The whole people elects. There's nothing wrong with the democratic process in politics. We arrived at the way we arrived by the American Constitution as it used to be. By the constitutional process, as we had it, people elect officials, but the powers of those officials, the powers of government, are strictly limited. They will have no right to initiate force or compulsion against any citizen, except a criminal. Those who have initiated force will be punished by force, and that is the only proper function of government. What we would not permit is the government to initiate force against people who have hurt no one, who have not forced anyone. We would not give the government or the majority or any minority the right to take the life or the property of others. That was the original American system.
When you say take the property of others, I imagine that you're talking now about taxes.
I am.
And you believe that there should be no right by the government to tax. You believe that there should be no such thing as welfare legislation, unemployment compensation, regulation during times of stress, certain kinds of rent controls and things like that.
That's right. I'm opposed to all forms of control. I am for an absolute, laissez-faire, free, unregulated economy. Let me put it briefly. I am for the separation of state and economics. Just as we had separation of state and church, which led to peaceful coexistence among different religions after a period of religious wars, so the same applies to economics. If you separate the government from economics, if you do not regulate production and trade, you will have peaceful cooperation and harmony and justice among men.
You are certainly enough of a political scientist to know that certain movements spring up in reaction to other movements. The labor movement, for instance, certain social welfare legislation. This did not spring full-blown from somebody's head, out of a vacuum. This was a reaction to certain abuses that were going on, isn't that true, Lyne?
Not always. It actually sprang up from the same source as the abuses. If by abuses you mean the legislation, which originally had been established to help industrialists, which was already a breach of complete free enterprise. If then, in reaction, labor leaders get together to initiate legislation to help labor, that it is only acting on the same principle, namely, all parties agreeing that it is proper for the state to legislate in favor of one economic group or another. But what I'm saying is that nobody should have the right, neither employers nor employees, to use state compulsion and force.
But when you advocate, completely unregulated economic life in which every man works for his own profit, you are asking, in a sense, for a devil-take-the-hindmost, dog-eat-dog society, and one of the main reasons for the growth of government controls was to fight the robber barons, to fight laissez-faire, in which the very people whom you admire the most, the hard-headed industrialists, the successful men, perverted the use of their power. Is that not true?
No, it isn't.
Oh.
This country was made not by robber barons, but by independent men, by industrialists who succeeded on sheer ability.
And
I mean without political force, help, or compulsion. But at the same time, there were men, industrialists, who did use government power as a club to help them against competitors. They were the original collectivists. Today, the liberals believe that that same compulsion should be used against the industrialists for the sake of workers. But the basic principle there is, should there be any compulsion? And the regulations are creating rubber bands. They are creating capitalism with government help, which is the worst of all economic phenomena.
I think that you will agree with me when I say that you do not have a good deal of respect for the society in which you and I currently live. You think that we're going downhill fairly fast. Now, I would like you to think about this question, and you'll have a minute intermission to ponder it, and then come back and answer it. Do you predict dictatorship and economic disaster for the United States if we continue on our present course? Do you? And we'll get Ayn Rand's answer in just a moment.
I think we're going to leave it there. Oh, we got... I think we've got a few more minutes.
This, since you describe it as happening in your novel, Atlas...
Okay, just two more minutes.
Do you actually predict dictatorship and economic disaster for the United States?
If the present collectivist trend continues, if the present anti-reason philosophy continues, yes, that is the way the country is going. But I do not believe in historical determinism, and I do not believe that people have to go that way. Men have the free will to choose and to think. If they change their thinking, we do not have to go into dictatorship.
Yes, but how can you expect to reverse this trend when, as we've said, the country is run by majority rule through ballot, and that majority seems to prefer to vote for this modified welfare state?
Oh, I don't believe that. You know as well as I do that the majority today has no choice.
What do you mean?
The majority has never been offered a choice between controls and freedom.
How do you account for the fact that an almost overwhelming majority of the people who are regarded as our leading intellectuals and our leading industrialists, the men whom you seem to admire the most, the men with the muscle and the money, favor the modified capitalism that we have today?
Because it is an intellectual issue. Since they all believe in collectivism, they do favor it. But the majority of the people has never been given a choice. You know that both parties today are for socialism, in effect, for control, and there is no party. There are no voices to offer an actual pro-capitalist, let's say fair, economic freedom and individualism. That is what this country needs today.
Isn't it possible that we all believe in it because we are all basically lonely people and we all understand that we are basically our brother's keepers?
You couldn't say that you really understand it because there is no way in which you could justify it. Nobody has ever given a reason why men should be the brother's keepers, and you've had every example, and you see the examples around you of men perishing by the attempt to be their brother's keepers.
You have no faith in any?
Faith?
Only in your mind.
That is not faith. That is a conviction.
Comments?
No, she died back in the mid-80s at some time, I think. Mid to late 80s. Maybe it was early 80s. I can't remember the exact time.
82.
Yeah, that's right. So what'd you think? Comments on anything she said? Or Mike Wallace is a great interviewer and still a great interviewer. Even though they're on opposite sides, I think he gave a really great interview and didn't step over her and challenged her in all kinds of ways without sort of, you know, giving her the Lawrence O'Donnell, Chris Matthews sort of, you know, treatment where you shout somebody down and don't let them speak. Yeah.
Does sentiment play any part in her philosophy?
She would say it's all that. Emotions flow from your values, so emotion is important to her, but you don't use that as a basis for making decision. So, what's a good example? Like if your highest value is your own happiness and producing things and being independent and self-sufficient, then you're going to feel proud of yourself when you make professional or financial achievements or invent something or create a great work of art. And so that the feelings will sort of flow from that. And if you have a relationship with a person you respect because of their excellent character or because you admire them in different sorts of ways for the person they are, then that's going to generate feelings of love. But if on the other hand you have a value system that says that you're basically as an individual that you need to justify yourself by helping people, then you're going to feel bad just making money or just inventing things or if you're not giving enough money away. Or if you have a relationship with a person who's independent and doesn't really need you, you're going to feel insecure and angry and you'll have all these sort of negative emotions. So, I mean, she does think emotions are important, but you shouldn't be ruled by your emotions. So your emotions will naturally stem from the value system that you have. And she thinks if you have a rational value system, you're going to feel good about life. And if you have a kind of screwed up value system where you think, well, I can never know anything, and I have no free will, stuff just happens to me, and I can't figure out why, and I should spend my time going around trying to make the evil, greedy, rich people pay for their sins and get them to share the wealth, you know, then you're gonna be a miserable person, she would say. Yeah.
One thing she said was that man's only obligation is to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes on in the text and says, others can have whatever they want, their own kind of collectivism, or whatever they wish, but they are not free to enforce it upon me and my elite. So they are not free to erase their collectivism at our expense. Now that seems to be the root part of her reasoning, is that if people imposing something on their elite, is man's only obligation is to himself. If that's a benefit to him, it seems like she should allow that that's how the person should act, even if it does impose on her, she's trying to make the system.
Well, I think what she's saying there is that if you want to have your commune and pool all your resources, knock yourself out. I'm not going to interfere with you. But just leave me out of it. But what happens is typically like the collectivists, they say, they look at these individualists who are like producing things like steel and skyscrapers, and they're like, hey, those rich, greedy so-and-sos, they got a lot of money, give me some of that. And then they, instead of going out with pitchforks and torches to storm the bank and steal all the money, they say, well, if we do that, we'll get arrested. So what we'll do is we'll go march and demonstrate or bribe some politicians and get them to pass a law to put an extra luxury tax or wealth tax or a regulation or something on the producers, and we'll sort of skim off the top and get some of that in the form of welfare payments or a minimum wage or a rule that says you have to join a union if you work in a certain industry, or to squeeze out foreign imports, to say if you want to buy steel from Japan that you have to pay an extra amount for it. So that sort of steers business towards domestic producers. And she notices she's also against so-called crony capitalism, which is really just a form of either fascism or socialism, where you have industries and government in bed together and individuals lose out. So she's totally against that. She's against government and business colluding together. She's for a totally laissez-faire system where businesses produce, and as you said, separation of economy and state. But the bit about the elites is just this idea that she wants to be left alone, essentially. She wants the right to be left alone and pursue her own interests, and thinks that the economy would be better off if without all these sort of government regulations and attempts to manage it.
she does want, unfortunately, I think the religion is true.
Well, I mean, you look at things now, it's kind of interesting. You have a couple of things. So first, you have the sort of the economic collapse, which is by and large caused by government regulation. So you had housing, all these housing programs, which subsidized people for buying houses they couldn't afford when they had no credit or bad credit, no job, and you had Fannie and Freddie Mac, which were put together to give loans to people that couldn't afford houses. And the idea is you sort of give all these people houses, and then that will boost the construction industry, and it will give people a form of forced savings because they'll be owners and not renters. And, you know, well-intentioned stuff, but what happens? Well, first of all, that money, all that, those loans and all those things are being siphoned out of the regular economy. That money can't come from thin air. And then so you have further banking regulations where the government said you need to give loans to these poor minority borrowers who otherwise wouldn't qualify. Otherwise, we're not going to give you that the permission to merge or acquire a new institution or to expand your operation or to do other things. And so also if you give these loans, we're going to guarantee these, so you have no risk. So you have this combination of the carrot and the stick. So if you don't give out all these bad loans to people, you're going to be punished. If you do, you're going to be rewarded. So what do the banks do? Well, you know, they give all these the so-called ninja loans, like no credit, no job, no problem. And then you have the Federal Reserve, which is controlling the money supply, again, government control, keeping interest rates really, really, really low. What happens when interest rates are really, really, really low beyond what the market would bear? Well, people borrow and borrow and borrow and borrow. So what you get is a bubble, and you had a housing bubble. And then even worse, the banks had all these bad mortgages. And they're like, well, the government's guaranteeing these, but I don't want these on our books. We need to get these out the door. I know what we'll do. We'll package them up together as an investment. We'll insure it, and then we'll sell it off, right? And so what would have been just like a U.S., you know, housing bubble turned into a worldwide financial collapse because people are like, hey, here's an investment. It's guaranteed by the U.S. government. How could I go wrong? And so, and you have these cascading effects into the global market. And so people, I mean, want to blame Wall Street and all this back-end stuff where you have all these mortgage-backed securities. Those securities never would have existed in the first place without the initial government steps which created the housing bubble. And so and Rand makes this point, is that when the government steps in and does these interventions which cause economic disasters, people look at this and they blame capitalism, where it's not capitalism at all, it's the reverse of capitalism. And this in turn leads for people to cry for more regulation, which makes things even worse, and then people blame capitalism again. And so you get, instead of having the problem solved, you get increasing regulations, which causes increasing problems. And if you look today at Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, all these socialist utopias are all going down in flames. They have huge unsustainable debts, and everybody's involved. So you have like Euro, and so you have all of Europe is sort of invested in not seeing Greece fail. And every week, it's like the chance of Greece, going bankrupt goes up, and people dump more money in, and then global markets respond. Oh, it looks like it's going to be fixed, and then it looks like they miss another payment, and it goes down again. And everybody owes money to everyone else, and central banks keep on printing money, and it's all the piper has to be paid sometime, and so it's all going down the tubes. And a lot of people see Atlas Shrugged as sort of a prophecy of what's going on with increasing state control of economies leading to economic collapse. Yeah.
Did I understand her correctly that she thought Constitution, with its strict limitation on government involvement, had been adhered to, that would be fine.
Yeah.
And this she was a movie supporter of the founding documents and the things they used to
do. Uh-huh, right. So she's not an anarchist. She's sort of like a mini-minarchist. So she thinks that, she said the only proper role of government is to protect people from the use of force. So basically to prosecute criminals and for national defense. And not sort of the empire building. She would be against that too. But for national defense of the homeland, like the army, to protect against foreign invasion, and also to punish, you know, thieves and murderers and rapists and vandals and so on. And you know, beyond that, she thought that you should have the freedom to live your life as you want. So she thought that, you know, prosecution of, you know, at the time in the 50s, you had people going to jail for being homosexuals. And she was against that. And she, you know, she was against people being prosecuted for using drugs. She thought there shouldn't be any drug laws. And so a lot of her views came into the, you know, the modern Libertarian Party. Remember, she talks about, well, there's no political party that basically gives you, that wants to defend free market capitalism. You get, you know, Tweedledum and Tweedledummer, the Democrats, which are hard socialists, and then the Republicans that are socialist light. And both want heavy government regulation and control. It's just the Republicans want a little, you know, some a little less than the Democrats. And so you have the Libertarian Party emerge as a sort of third option. And the Libertarian Party essentially Rand's political views without her ethics, metaphysics, and epistemology. So in some ways, she kind of didn't like. She thought the libertarians were kind of stealing her ideas without giving her credit for it. So in that way, she had some bad things to be say about the Libertarian Party. But by and large, they represent her political views, which is the separation of economy and state and a pretty, you know, a limited small government, you know, going back to sort of the founding fathers. And, you know, a lot of what you see in the Tea Party movement, this idea of going back to limited government and constitutional government. Other thoughts or comments? Criticisms.
How does she feel about those who are mentally or physically unable to care for themselves? Any idea?
Yeah, I think there she thought that, you know, there's you have family members, you have, and she wasn't against charity. She was against forced charity. Notice, like, a lot of what she said, she talked about voluntary relationships. And so she thought that, you know, nobody wants to see some guy, you know, a homeless person laying in the street. No one wants to see a friend or a family member, even a community member, without care. And so she thought that it's in people's interest to help people that can't help themselves. But she thought that it shouldn't be forced through taxation, but people who want to help should help those people. But it's not... She would say it's not an obligation. It's good to help people in need, but it's not an obligation. It's not something where money should be taken from you at gunpoint to help someone that the government says deserves help. So she would say family members, communities, you know, can help those people, but that's not the role of the government. The government is to protect you from the robber and the murderer and the, you know, the foreign despot. Yeah.
And so she's very similar to Thoreau, but how is she different from what he thought about individualism and self-sufficiency?
I think Thoreau was, more of an anarchist. She's very, very, very similar to Thoreau. Thoreau, in some places, he wants to talk about getting rid of the government completely. I think what Rand said, and she says a bunch of different things. Some people think that maybe Rand, in theory, could be what's called an anarcho-capitalist, as distinct from a lot of these people that call themselves anarchists that are like part of the Wall Street things. They just want to destroy stuff and break up stuff. They don't want, and they actually want some sort of, basically they're communists. They want a kind of a communal society where everyone's forced to live for everyone else. The kind of what would be Rand's, you know, collectivist nightmare. But the true anarchists, the people that want no government, they want complete individualism, would say, well, you could have a military, but you know, it'd be like. Everybody would chip in because nobody wants to be invaded. So the idea you would have some sort of monopoly in force, but it would be funded through, you know, donations essentially. And you think about it, if our military was funded through, you know, patriotic Americans, you know, give, and I think people would give for homeland defense, we wouldn't have the kind of bloated military, you know, that's sort of all around the world today. It would be a much more humbler and efficient military. and it wouldn't be acting as sort of a welfare program for soldiers, and we wouldn't still have troops in Germany and Japan left over from World War II, in Korea from the Korean War, and we have troops in Italy and Britain and bases all over the world, and you know, it costs a huge amount of money to pay for those things. And it tends to just make people angry and make us look like a big bully. So, but I think that between like the extreme minarchists and the anarchists, there's not necessarily a lot of. It's a matter of how far you're willing to go. And so Rand actually says that you need some monopoly use of force, because otherwise you sort of have competing gangs and you'd have warfare between private defense agencies or private militaries. And so the government's role is to have law and order, meaning to punish criminals and to create a climate where people have a way of arbitrating disputes. So to have a court system, to have jails and prisons for criminals, and to have an army to defend people. But the only legitimate use of the government is to prevent others from using force on you. If the government can't, she talks about the initiation of force too, which I think is an important word, initiation of force. So the initiation of force is wrong. Now if you use force on someone else, then the government can use force on you. But the government can initiate force on a private individual and say, you're selling liquor after 2 a.m., you're going to jail, or you're fined, or we're going to take away your right to sell alcohol right now because our rule says you can't sell liquor after 2 a.m. Or, I mean, Oregon, they have, like, state liquor stores, which is, I came out here from California, and I'm like, these people are even crazier than where I came from. They have, like, state licensed liquor stores. You can't go into the grocery store and buy hard liquor over a certain proof. It's just, and I'm like a teetotaler, but that just seemed bizarre to me. But just all the regulations about around business, she said, well, just get rid of all of them, and then if a business fails, let it fail. And so, like, during the economic crisis, Rand would say that what you need to do is let these bad actors who made bad decisions, let their businesses fail, let people buy them up and pennies on the dollar, and the economy is going to recover. If you have the government pumping money into these institutions that made all these bad decisions, you're just going to get more of the same, right? And of course, who's going to get bailed out, right? Why did Lehman Brothers go down, and what's the other one that got bailed out? Okay, why did Lehman Brothers go down, and why did AIG get bailed out? Well, AIG was, you know, more politically connected. Why, you know, why did GE get bailed out? Well, it's all like the unions, right? So, and you know, Jeffrey Immelt, surprise, surprise, is Obama's chief economic advisor. And you know, and who's getting all these subsidies for green jobs and curly light bulbs and stuff? Well, it's GE, right? So they're getting sort of all the benefits of government graft, and they're one of those people Rand was talking about, the GE and GM are both these businesses that collude with the government for special subsidies and regulations which squeeze out their competitors. Well, think about how this all relates to reason and egoism and laissez-faire capitalism and constitutional government with individual rights, and we'll talk some more about this next time and maybe talk about why egoism doesn't give you a view like Glaucon's, going back to the moral skeptical view. Whether egoism can really give you a robust conception of human rights, or whether a true egoist would go around looking for ways to shaft people for his own benefit. And so we'll talk about that on Wednesday. And get into Hobbes and social conflict.